The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we're talking about the things that we think make humans unique as a species. We're joined by Dr. Karen Bondar, biologist and author, to talk about the book, The Nature of Human Nature, Reflections on Our Position as Natural Entities in the Animal Kingdom. This week, let's begin the show a bit differently. We've previously had science enthusiast and hip-hop activist Baba Brinkman on the show to talk about his album, The Rap Guide to Evolution. His latest release is jam-packed with lyrical science goodness, and it's the perfect soundtrack for our topic this week. This is You Can't See Me, the opening track from Baba's newest album, The Rap Guide to Human Nature. Enjoy.
The blind stares of a million pairs of third eyes, looking hard, but they don't realize that they will never see reality.
Can you see behind the screen? Nothing's as it seems. Can you see me?
Can't see me. Can't nobody see me. You can't see me like Stevie Wonder.
Who am I? I ain't nothing but a tour guide using science like an x-ray to see into your mind. I'm a voracious reader and a ruthless questioner. So if you hate the way I see things, don't shoot the messenger. But I'm not gonna lie, I get a personal thrill whenever I see science get popularized. So no, I'm not objective. Good thing science has something called a method that we can use to cross-reference and acquire knowledge that's really authentic. That's how we know the solar system is heliocentric. And that's how we know Charles Darwin's theory was right. And every living creature is connected through the tree of life. Yeah, welcome to the future, baby. A time when science is even illuminating the roots of human behavior. So why do fish swim well and birds fly well? For the same reason human beings lie to themselves. You can't see me, which means you can't clock me. You can't tell which parts of my signal are costly. You can't see me, which means you can't test me. Your cheater detection instincts can't detect me. You can't see me, I'm the invisible gorilla. The blind spot in your vision that your mind has to fill up. You can't see me, but if you can't see me, just imagine what else you can't see. So just close your eyes when you listen to rap, and you'll find a microcosm of the human mental map. Everything from costly signaling to kin selection. Cause face it, you can't see your motives with introspection. It's simply how the human mind has been designed. That's why my mom thinks that I'm the greatest rapper alive. That's evolution, it's genetic nepotism. And yes, rap is a sexually selected exhibition. That's why rappers are so obsessed with Fortnite. Maybe high status males just prefer short term mating. And if you don't think status is real, just think back to the last time you had a rejection. How did it feel? Whether a job application or a chat with the person next to you, having status is having people say yes to you. So how do I get you to say yes to me as a rap guy? Should I get a PhD or swing more to the gangster side? You can't see me, so just close your eyes. You let my identity be a total surprise. So you can't see me, yeah, I'm jamming your signal. Who cares what I look like? Don't be so judgmental. You can't see me. And what if I claim that I was from the streets, just trying to get out of the game? Yeah, you can't see me. And what if I said that I just freestyle all these lyrics off the top of my head?
I'm talking today with Karen Bondar, biologist and author of The Nature of Human Nature, Reflections on Our Position as Natural Entities in the Animal Kingdom. Welcome to Skeptically Speaking, Karen.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you've written an entire book about the way that we think that things that make humans human are not quite so special as we think they are.
Yes, exactly. I spend a lot of time thinking about really strange behaviors that humans do. And I guess as a biologist, I always kind of want a biological context for things that we do. And there are just so darn many things that we do that make no sense as far as a survive and reproduce standpoint goes. And as a biologist, of course, we ascribe all sorts of these principles to all other animals. So yeah, the book sort of stemmed out of me just looking at somebody eating a bag of chips and going, why are you doing that? That doesn't make any sense. And just, you know, loving how we are so odd in that way. However, the animal kingdom is also dotted with exceptions to the rule. And that's kind of where the book gets a little bit more interesting. There are animals that eat junk food. There are animals that use contraception and do all these kinds of funny things. So it's basically about where do humans fit in? Do we fit in? And so everybody can make their own choices, I suppose, after reading all of the examples, whether we actually are part of nature or whether we've just gone off on some kind of trajectory that's of course, I suppose you definitely have to call that natural based on the fact that we're a product of evolution, but it certainly doesn't fit in with a lot of the other members of the animal kingdom.
Well, you wrote about the idea that we think that we're the only species that engages in acts that aren't designed specifically to enable us to survive or reproduce. So Is that or is that not true then?
I would say in no species is it as ubiquitous as it is in ours, but certainly not. There are animals out there that are doing things that in no way contribute to their survival or reproductive success on smaller scales. A lot of sex, for example, is taking place without a reproductive motive. Whether or not there's an ultimate reproductive motive as in terms of are we practicing, are we, those kinds of questions for some species have been answered, but for others, there are simply just unanswered mysteries about why they do these sorts of things. We humans tend to kind of put ourselves above all other animals. Well, we're too good for that. We don't do things like that. We're a little bit more refined than that. And really, when it comes right down to it, there's a lot of animals that are doing a lot of things that are a lot more refined than what we do. If you look at it straight down to the facts, the real story about how animals elegantly perform their day-to-day tasks, a lot of the times they're kicking our butts big time.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. I'm on the line with Karen Bondar, biologist and author of The Nature of Human Nature, Reflections on Our Position as Natural Entities in the Animal Kingdom. So let's start out with some areas where we do differ from other animals, first of all. Food and nutrition is a big one. We seem to be the only animal that needs help maintaining proper nutrition.
You know, and I love this topic. I love talking about this because it is just something that, especially, of course, a lot of the human examples that I use in the book are based on the Western world. Of course, the Western world is where I live and where I have experienced most of my life. And so, yeah, I mean, we're in the Western world. We are so messed up when it comes to food and nutrition. So we are the only species that requires the food pyramid, for example. And we, you know, we have this nifty little chart that gives us an idea about, okay, how many grains to include and how many meats and how many, you know, fats, oils, and sweets and so on. My son just graduated kindergarten, and of course he learned all about the food pyramid. And so, you know, when you sort of break it down in terms of the fact that we need to teach ourselves how to eat, this is really a little embarrassing in the animal kingdom because, you know, other animals, sure, they may show their offspring where to forage or how to make a certain type of kill. But as far as the components of the diet are concerned, no other animal species does it. Now, to add insult to injury, we have this food pyramid. So you think, okay, we all know the answers then. We can all get this right because somebody made this diagram and it tells you how to do it. But despite having this, most of us in the Western world have a very poor diet and we don't follow this, even though we know that we should be. And so, yeah, a cockroach, for example, is an organism that has a very bad rap among humans. We tend to think about cockroaches as a very lowly organism. You know, you can call somebody a cockroach or, you know, step on them. They're gross. They're disgusting, whatever. But this organism and German cockroaches in particular are extremely sophisticated when it comes to selecting their diet. And so, the example that I discuss in the book is some researchers who manipulated the diet of cockroaches and basically put them into different dietary groups experimentally. So some of them were extremely deficient in protein, some of them were extremely deficient in carbohydrate, et cetera, et cetera. And they exposed them to these dietary deficiencies for a number of days. What they did after these deficiencies were very well established in these organisms is they went ahead and put them into a buffet situation, basically, and they allowed them to eat whatever they wanted to. Within 48 hours of being exposed to this buffet, all of the cockroaches in the experimental groups had completely reversed any of the dietary deficiencies that they had been exposed to. So they just knew how to correct the damage that had been done to their diet and to their body, perhaps, by being exposed experimentally to these very deficient diets. And I mean, talk about sophistication. Then, you know, once they had replaced what it was that they needed, they just went ahead and continued with their balanced diet after that. I mean, and so somebody like, you know, several humans, I mean, most humans in the Western world who just live on this crazy diet of junk food and fast food and so on and so on, and we sort of don't really have any idea what our body needs on any given day. We just kind of go with what's convenient or what's around. And so I like to bring that example up because the cockroaches are doing it so well, and we are not.
Well, in most animals, when they do any kind of food preparation, and there are examples of that in animals, they do it to increase the nutritional value of food and not so much with us.
I know. That's a great point. I mean, a lot of the times the ways in which we manipulate our food tend to take nutritional value out of the food. If, you know, deep frying is a perfect example. And even most cooking techniques, cooking in vegetables especially tends to decrease the amount of nutrients that are available in those. Now, herbivores have to be careful because a lot of plants in the, you know, natural world are highly toxic. Of course, these organisms, the plants, are actually very highly adapted to get rid of these herbivores that want to munch on them. And so a lot of the times plants have to be detoxified, and a lot of herbivores have found their way around that. But yeah, what we do with our foods, we actually make it less nutritious, even though it would have been perfectly good to begin with. And the raw food diet is something that's, you know, this new craze, and everyone's thinking, oh, raw food, how about that? Isn't that novel and interesting? Well, guess what? You know, 99.9% of the organisms on the planet are utilizing the raw food diet. Like, it's really not all that novel. But it makes a lot of sense. But, you know, you do have to take into account that herbivores manipulate their food to make it better for them in terms of leaching out toxins and things like that.
Well, humans, though, unlike some other kinds of animals, we can eat practically any kind of food.
Yes. That's true. We are specializing in generalists, and we are omnivores. So, I mean, we eat from any kind of food group. And something that's really interesting about humans is, of course, being specializing generalists, we basically can eat anything, but in certain areas of the world, we tend to focus on certain things. So, of course, you know, I live near a major city, Vancouver, where you can get wonderful cuisines from all over the place. And you have groups of people, for example, you know, in Japanese cuisine, you might think of something like sushi. Italian, you may think of pasta. Indian, you may think of curry or something like that. Well, there are organisms, especially herbivores, that are specializing generalists as well. And this is basically based, again, on the fact that a lot of plant foods need to be detoxified. And so an organism, a fly, for example, that needs to feed on a certain kind of plant food way across the world is going to have to detoxify these plants that are a whole lot different than the ones we might find here in North America. And so these are specializing generalists as well. And so in the same way that we might have guacamole when we're in Mexico, the flies that come from Mexico are adapted to detoxify a whole bunch of different foodstuffs than the ones that would live here. So it's kind of interesting to think about things that way. We as humans are very, very lucky in terms of not only our accessibility to all of these wonderful foodstuffs, but again, to the fact that we don't have to detoxify them. And in general, we have chefs and other restaurateurs that are able to prepare them for us in exactly the way that we want.
Well, and here's where the similarities start. I found out that we aren't actually the only species that eats junk food.
Yes, indeed. I love this example because, you know, you just want an excuse. I mean, it tastes so good. It's easy to get. I mean, and I'm a culprit of it, I have to admit, from time to time. But we aren't the only species that eat junk food. In a lot of the northern oceans, there in the last decade or so, there has been a complete restructuring of the fish food chain. And what used to be areas that were full of high fat, high protein species have now been replaced with a lot of lower fat, lower quality species like walleye pollock. And this replacement of the fish communities has actually been concurrent with a drastic decline in the marine mammal populations, especially those of sea lions and seals. These organisms have been declining rapidly, and it's thought that it's possibly due to the fact this food chain has been restructured to be a junk food-based food chain, if you will. And in fact, the junk food hypothesis is a very widely researched hypothesis in the literature, and it's basically looks a lot at the fact that these organisms are essentially forced to eat junk food. And so, you know, there is a little difference in there. You know, they're not making a selection of, instead of having that salad, let's have a hot dog. No, right. They're actually being forced to eat this junk food. But what's interesting, some research that was done out of the Vancouver Aquarium actually looked at the energetic requirements of juvenile sea lions. And so what they did is they, using all sorts of their physiological monitors, fed juvenile sea lions with this diet of this junk food, the walleye pollock. And they found out that the physiological requirements for swimming could not be met by a diet of only walleye pollock, which is a very scary thing. It basically means that even if these guys were just eating constantly, they still wouldn't be able to eat enough to meet what their bodies require for active life. And of course, these guys expend a ton of energy, you know, swimming and diving and hunting and all of that sort of thing. It's quite a serious situation, and they are in fact eating junk food. Though we have to forgive them because it's
they don't have a choice.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we're also not the only species that likes to invite others to dinner. I like this.
Well, exactly. We especially as moms, you and I are both moms, and we know that there are certain food signaling calls that happen around the households around meal time. Generally speaking, the moms, once we've prepared a meal, we let others know that that meal is available. But, you know, there's some parameters that we put onto that because we don't necessarily want our food signaling calls to be going out to the entire neighborhood. We don't need everybody showing up to eat the food that we have spent our resources and our time preparing. So a lot of animals in the animal kingdom are in a similar situation. They may want to extend an invitation to some of their close kin to share in some foodstuffs, but they may not want everybody to know about it. So there's some really good examples, especially with other primates, that have a look at the sort of psychology behind, do I share or do I keep this to myself? And in a lot of cases, several primate species will keep that food to themselves for at least a little bit of time, until they've been either spotted or until they've had a chance to partake in enough of it themselves. Now, in species like rhesus macaques, there have been studies that have looked at the repercussions of not sharing. And so what happens is if one individual comes upon a collection of food, and this would be experimentally set up, researchers are actively looking at how this individual will react. Now, if there are others within close vicinity, okay, we're going to call right away. There's no question of that. If there aren't others, we might take a second, but we're always going to make that call. Because if we get caught not making that call, there will be social repercussions and we won't get as much food in the long run. So, you know, yes, okay, we might share, and we always, you know, as moms, as human moms, we'll do that. We'll share, but, you know, do we grab a few bites first? And I'm certainly a culprit of that, you know? So it's kind of interesting to look at the parameters behind who are we sharing with and how are we choosing to share and when are we choosing to share.
I'm actually thinking this is my office lunchroom in a nutshell.
Yeah, it depends on exactly what the foodstuffs are. That's true.
And it also turns out that humans aren't the only ones that tend herds. Ants herd aphids?
Yeah, this is a great example. And I love this example because it is farming in a nutshell. So, I mean, humans, of course, are masters of the art of farming. I live in a small farming community in the Fraser Valley, and I certainly partake in the rewards of things that farming can bring up, all these wonderful vegetables and cheeses and things like that. And so what happens with ants and aphids? Now, ants aren't actually after the aphids for meat. What they're after is the honeydew that the aphids produce. They produce this little secretion of a very sugary substance out their back end that is very highly nutritious. Of course, it's full of sugar, so it's full of energy. The ants want to basically cultivate this. And so aphids, who are subjected to predation by a lot of other animals, get protection from the ants. If the ants are herding them onto certain plants, ants will then prevent other predators from entering into that environment, much, you know, in the same way that a farmer will herd off his cattle or whatever animal, you know, whatever species they're farming. We're protecting those cows or that corn or whatever from either invasive plants or other predators. We're making sure that we're basically raising a monoculture in a protected environment. And that's exactly what these aphids, what's happening to these aphids and what the ants are doing. So some studies that looked at exactly what the ants' herding behavior, the effects that this had on the biodiversity of the surrounding environment. And what they found was not surprising, that where ants were protecting aphids and essentially herding them, the biodiversity of those communities on the rest of the plant was quite low. However, when they removed the aphids, and then of course the tending ants took off because there was no there anymore, the biodiversity of these areas increased, you know, upwards of 30%. So it's a perfect mini scale example of what farming does. It's perfect for the ants, akin to the fact that our farms are perfect for us. But they aren't necessarily perfect for the rest of the organisms that would have otherwise utilized that space, for their, you know, day to day, whatever that may be. And so I sort of make a little bit of a light of the situation by saying that, of course, at the scale of a tree, which is what these studies and these ants are doing, it's not such a big deal because there are several trees in the forest that have, that don't have aphids and ants and this kind of, relationship happening. And so there is still a lot of diversity, even at this small scale. However, the scale at which we take our farming, you know, we know that it's sort of expanded beyond anything that could be recoverable from a biodiversity standpoint. So, you know, that's where the humans are different from the other animals that utilize the techniques of farming. We're kind of taking that, again, like humans do, we're taking it a couple steps too far, probably.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking. We're talking about the nature of human nature with biologist Karen Bondar. And we'll be right back after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com. Or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and today we're talking about how the disparity among humans and animals is often not as vast as one might think. My guest is Karen Bondar, biologist and author of The Nature of Human Nature, Reflections on Our Position as Natural Entities in the Animal Kingdom. So humans also act similarly to other animals when dealing with illness, then?
Yeah, exactly. Only in a lot of these illness examples, I am quite happy to be human. I make a lot of fun of humans in a lot of these chapters because, frankly, you know, we're kind of pathetic when it comes to things like diet, especially. But when it comes to healthcare, okay, I like what we've got going on because it's very easy to be a human in the Western world. If I get a cut, if I get a scrape, if I get a cold, any kind of infection, chances are I'm going to be covered with fairly little effort on my part. I walk into a clinic, I get a Band-Aid, I get some alcohol, some disinfectant. You know, animals don't generally have all of these choices available to them very easily. So for example, in a coral reef, this is an environment where corals can be very sharp, and large fish tend to get great big wounds quite often. There's sharp corals, there are very pointy and urchins and things like that, and the rate of surface wounds of large fish is actually quite high. However, the rate of recovery of surface wounds from fish is also quite high. And this is due to the fact that there are little medical clinics in coral reefs, and these are known as cleaning stations. Now, cleaning stations serve kind of a dual function. They do clean cleaner fish or shrimp, but generally speaking, they're more fish that do this. They basically chew off little ectoparasites, or they chew off infected tissue if a fish happens to have a gaping wound. And basically clean that wound, same as if you were to go to a medical clinic and get help for a wound, for a bandage change or anything like that. So there are some examples, and a coral reef is such a good example because the recovery rate of major gashes is close to 100% in a lot of the areas that have been studied. And that's due to the fact that there are these little clinics. If you don't happen to live in a coral reef, you are not quite so lucky. And so, of course, animals are subjected to a lot greater injury than we are, based on the fact that we can easily get cleaned up in most cases. Now, that's an external wound, an external problem. Internal problems are, of course, another major issue. Parasitic infections are something that are ubiquitous in the animal kingdom, and especially in a lot of our primate cousins. Parasitic infections are extremely common. Now, we humans, of course, are not immune to these either, but we can look after ourselves as far as getting immunized if we know we're going to be traveling to an area that has these kinds of organisms, or we can certainly get medications for them should we fall victim to some kind of a parasitic infection. But our large primate cousins cannot do the same thing. So what's been found is that a lot of the great apes, when they're plagued with these parasitic, so I'm thinking about little nematodes that are just full right in the gut, all sorts of the developmental stages. You've got everything from the large, large for a nematode, so these are still very tiny, half centimeter at most, all the way down to their larval cases, which insist in the gut. And these kind of infections are happening all the time. And so what the great apes will do is they will take some leaves, some very specific kinds of leaves that have a lot of surface area, first of all, that have very scratchy patches. These are called trichomes, and they're basically patches that are covered with little fibers that help to scour out the gut. So they'll take these leaves, fold them up very carefully, because what they're wanting to do is they're wanting to create a lot of surface area, and then they swallow them whole. Now, don't ask me how the gag reflexes, they must have evolved, because I can't imagine swallowing something like that whole. But basically, what the effect of doing this is, these leaves scour out the gut, they come out the other end, unadulterated, basically, but carrying both the larval forms of parasitic nematodes and the adult forms. And so, chimps and orangutans that are infected with these kind of organisms will sit and do this up to 40 or 50 times in a row. And they'll just ingest these leaves, out they come, and they generally do it first thing in the morning when the gut is sort of flushed already. And I mean, oh, what a horrible thing to have to do.
But that's brilliant. That is brilliant that they do that.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and it's certainly extremely effective. And what I've noticed from a lot of the medical examples that I use in the book is that humans tend to mirror what we've noticed in the animal kingdom. So the whole field of ethnomedicine comes from observing what happens in the natural world. Aromatherapy is something that is extremely common here in the Western world, although this again is where we get a little bit sidetracked, you know, with our florally room sprays and our body lotions and all sorts of things that are meant to be aromatherapy based, but really we're not exactly sure what that means to us anymore. But a lot of organisms utilize the powers of natural aromatic compounds in order to dispel ectoparasites. So, for example, a lot of birds in their nests will include sprigs of yarrow or other compounds that are extremely aromatic. And this is to protect their young hatchlings, because basically young hatchling birds sitting in a nest are a target for things like mosquitoes or other ticks, things like this. So some birds will use just yarrow or one compound in particular. Others will use a whole potpourri of species that each contributes its own unique property. And they've been found to be extremely effective in deterring ectoparasites of all kinds. And so aromatherapy is very important and effective in its natural form. What we do is kind of just, you know, silly surface stuff. And I mean, half the time what we are using as aromatherapy products are kind of doing the opposite thing that they are meant to do in the natural world, which is we use sweet smelling things and things that are very fragrant that may actually attract mosquitoes or other ectoparasitic organisms. But then, of course, we turn around and we have, you know, bug sprays that are poisonous, so then we can just spray them and be done with it. So anyway, we kind of get it wrong on the aromatherapy point, but other organisms are certainly utilizing those powers, and they are very powerful.
Well, you mentioned vaccines. Now, you write that some animals seem to have a way of positively affecting their immune systems without the benefit of going for a flu shot.
And then this is so interesting to me because, of course, I live on the West Coast where, you know, it just gets cold and yucky and rainy for a good portion of the year. And so this being our flu season, people actively line up for their flu shots. And basically this inoculation is meant to help out for, you know, preventing various viral strains that come up during these seasons when we're all expending a little bit more energy to stay warm and stay healthy. And then, of course, we're all gathering together in indoor spaces and sharing germs with one another. And it's not a good scene generally. So we rely on these interventions like our inoculations to try to stay healthy. Of course, other organisms don't have this ability. And so some migrating birds, for example, which will have to fly through various places that have various germs and viruses about, these birds will have to change what their immune system needs to do based on what's happening in their lives. So when they are undergoing a period of migration, when they are continuously exposed to new viruses, new bacteria, their immune systems become a whole lot more fine-tuned. And of course, this has been shown through a lot of blood work and various testing using physiological mechanisms. And then when they settle into their nesting site, which tend to be much more widely spaced, they're not coming into contact with a whole bunch of different organisms, and different viruses, therefore, their immune systems get a chance to relax a bit, and they can use their energy instead to concentrate on other things like reproduction. When they're down, sort of established in their territories, it's not as imperative for them to have a very fine-tuned immune system. And I just think this example is so compelling that these, you know, a lot of different migrating bird species have this kind of capability. I mean, they need to have it. If they're going to be flying through a whole bunch of different areas, their immune system has to be able to cope with that. But then when they don't need that anymore, their body is actually able to take that energy and expend it elsewhere, somewhere else that it's going to be more relevant for them and whatever purpose it is, most likely reproduction. And it's just, it's mind-boggling. It's wonderful to see. And then, so I feel again, like humans, oh, yeah, we suck.
Evolution is amazing. And it's unfortunate that humans have seem to have fallen down on the job in some of these areas.
Yeah, sometimes I feel as though, you know, our brains have become so large that we have been able to develop things like flu shots and inoculations and things that in principle are meant to make our bodies function better. But is that in some way then taking away the natural processes that our bodies should go through in order to stay fit against these kinds of things? You know, it's a classic example of you know, I have 3.6 children right now, and they, you know, do you let them play outside and get dirty and get exposed to all of these things so that their bodies can naturally become used to them and naturally be able to fight them? Or do we go with that antibacterial soap and the wipes and all of these things that we, you know, we sort of tell ourselves that these things are better, but I don't think that they necessarily are. They're taking away our body's natural ability to deal with things.
And there actually have been a number of recent studies on things like bacterial wipes and such, and how that is actually turning out to be kind of detrimental to us.
Indeed. In a lot of, you know, I think we sort of see this trend in a lot of areas, in the bacterial, antibacterial soaps and wipes and all of those things. Yeah, it's not helping us any at all. In fact, it's making us weaker. And again, another good example here is the fever. So, I mean, a fever is something that anybody's body, whether you're a caterpillar or, an endoth or anything endothermic, your body is going to respond to an invader by heating up. And if your automatic response to that is to cool it down again, well, you're kind of missing the point. And so there's a topic that I talk about in the book, which is don't kill the fever. I mean, of course, it's very traumatizing, for parents to see their small child, burning up with fever, because fevers can backfire and they can go too far. But it's also important, if they're not going too far, to let them run their course. They have a very important biological function, and that is to kill the invading organism. And in endotherms, like we are, we do this automatically, but in ectotherms, in animals, invertebrates and other animals that don't have an internally regulating heat system, they will actually seek out a hot place to go and hang out if they have an infection. So this is called a behavioral fever. And so several experiments that were done on crickets actually looked at how they would behave if they were inoculated with a certain kind of bacterium or virus. So we give them a sickness and we see what they do. And what they do is they go and hang out where it's hot, because they, you know, for however they're doing it, they know that that's what is what where they need to be in order to stop the spread of this invader in their bodies. So yeah, again, with the whole antibacterial movement and the whole anti-fever movement, we really need to check ourselves at the door. These things are not really bad for us. They have a really important function.
To play devil's advocate for a moment, I want to make sure we're not doing too much anthropomorphizing here. You know, there are definitely parallel behaviors between humans and animals, but is there any danger in linking these two closely, do you think?
There is a need to always make sure that we're looking at these. Like, it's not like a cricket is saying, gee, I'm sick.
Right.
I have to go and make myself better. But what we don't necessarily understand is the physiology or what's happening between the inoculation of that bug into their bodies and them actually functionally going and correcting that. We don't know exactly whether that's an entirely physiological process. I suppose that it is an entirely physiological process, but it's not something that we understand start to finish just yet.
Right.
And I guess you're absolutely right in that biologists, we do tend to anthropomorphize by way of example. And I think it's a really useful way to sort of explain a lot of concepts and a lot of topics, but you're right, I should probably check myself at the door sometimes. I do like to anthropomorphize because it just tends to make examples make sense.
Absolutely. And also the fact that, again, as you mentioned earlier, humans like to think that they're better than everything else.
We certainly do. I'd love to just think of that cockroach, you know, giving us the bird while he's getting his diet all, you know, set up. What do you think you're doing? But anyway, yeah.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and my guest today is Karen Bondar, biologist and the author of The Nature of Human Nature. Before we take another break, here's another track from Baba Brinkman and The Rap Guide to Human Nature. This one's called Hypothesis 5, Evolutionism, and we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking.
Truly amazing. From the allure of a beautiful lady, to the taste of food, to the roots of human nature. But if you think it's just genes duplicating, don't be too hasty. The genes inside of us outcompeted rival genes, and some of them arrived on the scene by violent means. But others arrived by designing minds that dream and learn how to settle rivalries using things like rhyme schemes. Evolution explains design in nature as the selective retention of blind variation, and that's exactly how the mind explores design spaces. And when it finds something nice, it says, damn, I'm creative. So it's time to turn the page on that played out nature versus nurture debate. Cause every urge, every murderous rage, and every peacemaking word that we say is just the product of one simple process: churning away.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're joined by graduate student and researcher Abby Smith to learn about the latest research on the human immunodeficiency virus. How does HIV cause AIDS? What are the latest treatments? How close are we to a cure? What strategies are most effective at stopping the spread of infection? And what are the arguments that denialists make for alternate causes of the disease? All of that next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and we're talking about the fine line between nature and human nature. My guest is Karen Bondar, author of The Nature of Human Nature, Reflections on Our Position as Natural Entities in the Animal Kingdom. So at the start of the show, we spoke about how often we think about animal behaviors as being directly related to their ability to help them survive or reproduce. So let's talk about that last bit, the reproduction part.
It always goes there, doesn't it? But you know what? There's a reason that it always goes there. I mean, sex is important. There's really, none of us would be here if it weren't for sex. So yeah, there's so many interesting topics to discuss when it comes to reproduction. It's aside from surviving, it's any animal's number one priority.
Let's go with something well known to start, the fact that birds attract mates through feather coloration. So what are some other examples of using appearance to find a partner?
So there are some wonderful examples all from several phyla as far as sexually selected traits go. We always tend to think of that male peacock with his beautiful feathers, but everything from lizards to fish to big antlers on deer to big throat flanges and orangutans, all sorts of, and it's generally the males, because it's usually the males who have to woo the females, but we see all sorts of characteristics that basically are sexually selected, and that means the bigger the better, the flashier the better, the females are going to go for the ones that are the most beautiful. Now, this always kind of puzzles me when I think about the human species, because of course we appreciate beautiful humans too. We like to look at, you know, males like to look at beautiful females, females like to look at beautiful males, but the difference in our species is that beauty doesn't necessarily equal health and good genes, which it does in the animal kingdom. There are so many unnatural interventions that we do to our own external appearances. And I mean, you can think about anything from the clothes you wear to the makeup on your face to the hair dye, or, you know, even things that are a little bit more crazy, you know, to the piercings, to the tattoos, to all of these things that we do that really have nothing to do with our health or our genetics. And so beauty is kind of defined a whole lot differently in our species. And that's something I find really interesting. I feel like beauty interventions make us dishonest mates. No other animal is able to basically put on mascara and think they look better.
Right.
But we are.
So how exactly do you think that affects our evolution then?
Well, that's a great point. I mean, I think that, you know, it's, in humans, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why in humans it's not really survival of the fittest. You know, if you want to think about a whole wealth of things, from the fact that, you know, it doesn't matter if you can't see or if you can't hear, or if you, you know, if you're in an accident and you can't even walk, or something like this. These things, as a human, it doesn't matter. You can be a functionally, perfectly functional, happy member of society, and it's not a problem. In the animal kingdom, that is a problem. Because if you can't see and you're a bird, you know, you're done. So there's a whole lot of different ways, with respect to both beauty and health that we have, changed the way that our populations evolve. There's no question about that.
There's a neat one that you mentioned that I'd never heard of, cross-dressing. Other species do this too then.
I know. And it's, again, in the human species, why are we doing this? I mean, other than the fact that it's just enjoyable and it's fun, there's no biological purpose to it. However, in a lot of animals, you know, humans tend to have a very happy, romantic sense of how sex should go. And how we should, you know, all sort of love each other, and it's always gentle and wonderful and happy and things like this. Most animals, sex is not fun. It's not easy. Males and females are often competing for totally different things. Females often don't want males who are trying to enforce themselves on her, and so on. So there are a lot of animals that cross dress, and this. For a female to appear as a male is often advantageous if she is not interested in having males court her, which is very often the case. For a male, it's sometimes advantageous to appear as a female. And this may be, for example, in Galapagos iguanas, when younger males who are sexually mature, but they're not the big men on campus just yet, they sneak into colonies and appear as females so that they can get close to females. And because otherwise the larger males among colonies, the big bullies, they will, you know, do their bully thing and not allow them to mate with females. And so we've got females dressing up as males, males dressing up as females. It's a big crazy puzzle all over the place.
And it turns out that the male preoccupation with virginity is also not specific to humans.
Exactly. It's very common. Basically, all over the animal kingdom, males and females are generally coming at sex from two different points of view. Sperm is very cheap. It's easy to produce. A man can produce a ton of it. It's, you know, so what he wants to do is the problem that males have is that they want to ensure that they are the father of a certain female's eggs. Okay, so they just want to get it out there. They want to make sure that it's theirs, and they just want to spread the seed. Females, on the other hand, have to produce eggs, which are a lot more costly to produce. And I mean, in a lot of species, the human species, I'm 6.5 months pregnant right now. You know, once an egg has been produced and fertilized, now I am out of commission for 9 months and potentially a few more after that. And so it's a big commitment. So females, therefore, are generally very choosy. I'm not just going to let any sperm in there. Because I have such a big commitment to make. And so what we generally see is males, they will want females who are virgins because it says to them, okay, she hasn't had anybody else. Therefore, I have a big chance of fertilizing those eggs. And so in species like guppies, a lot of fish species, they use olfactory cues or cues that are, that they can smell basically that are in the water, and they can tell if she has already mated, and if she has, not interested. Now females, on the other hand, of course, because we are being so choosy about the sperm that specifically gets to fertilize our eggs, we don't want just any guy, and we certainly don't want a virgin, because chances are if nobody else wanted him, he doesn't have anything good to offer. To put it bluntly, you know, you see a lot of social systems in which there is an alpha male who mates with all the females, and that's because he's the biggest one, the strongest one, the one with the greatest genetic power, and therefore all the girls want him. And so we're coming at this from very different points of view. So I'm not sure that human males are thinking about their reproductive potential when they're thinking about deflowering a virgin. I'm pretty sure they're not. But maybe that might be something that's biologically programmed, because it certainly is very common through the animal kingdom.
Well, when you talk about females being choosy, it's interesting because different species, of course, are choosy about different characteristics specifically. Like orangutans are concerned about temperament.
Absolutely. And certainly in a lot of species where males can be very aggressive, it makes a lot of sense for females to test that temperament. Males can be extremely damaging to a female physically, both in primates and a lot of other species. And so, yeah, what female orangutans tend to do specifically is when they're testing out a potential mate, they will engage him in some food sharing. Now, food sharing, okay, as humans, we share food all the time. It's really rare in most other species to share food between unrelated individuals.
Right.
And so what these female orangutans will do is they'll see if he's willing to share a little bit of his food. And it's not anything that she can get herself. That's not the point. It's the most common thing. It's the fries. You know, give me a few of your fries. This is the most common thing. I could easily get my own, but I want some of yours. And it's her way of basically testing out his temperament, because he's going to share. Chances are he's going to not be as aggressive with her, and he may be a better father figure and help out more with the potential offspring. And so, yeah, this has been documented in several experiments that have looked specifically at the food sharing behaviors between orangutans and whether gestating females, so females who are already pregnant, they don't tend to engage in food sharing at all. There's no point. They're not interested. So, but ones who are receptive and ready to go, they're the ones who will actively seek out food sharing. And if males don't share, they don't get any from her.
So many parallels.
I know, exactly. It's wonderful.
Now, we also find out that we are not the only species to use contraception.
Yeah, now this is a really, really interesting one. So all of baboons, this was research done in Nigeria. And so again, another one of our closest relatives, these primates, it turns out that when the African black plum is in season, which isn't, you know, very often, it's got a short blooming season in these forests of Nigeria. When it is available, females, not males, but females will actually go and just basically gorge on it. And this is a plant, a fruit that has a high level of progesterone in it. And it basically has the same effect on their physiology as the contraceptive pill. It shuts them down completely. And I spoke with the researcher who did this work at length, and you know, and he was adamant about how it was the nutritious properties of the plum. And then later, some subsequent work that they've done since they published the book has shown that maybe for the female orangutans for the baboon, taking a little bit of time off from the cycle helps them to become even more fertile in future cycles. So there's these two lines of thought. Okay, despite the fact that these African black plums seem to be causing infertility in these female baboons, they're so nutritious that we'll forgive them. And they're causing them to skip a cycle, but then they get even more fertile, so we'll forgive them that too. You know, and I just kind of, I want to say, maybe these girls just want a break. Maybe they're like, woohoo, plum season. Like, let's, you know, go for it. I mean, certainly human females do not have as many offspring as their bodies will allow. Most of us,
right,
have a couple of them and that's it, which is very strange, I suppose, in the animal kingdom. But these are among our closest relatives, and I think it wouldn't be totally out of the question to cut these females a little slack.
And I am fond of engaging in speculation, as long as we're saying, this is speculation.
Totally.
I would like to think of baboons or orangutans or any animal really deciding that they will or not have children.
And that's me sort of going that anthropomorphic route again, but we tend to forget that we are so closely related to these organisms and we don't allow them free thought. And I don't know that that's entirely correct.
So what are we learning from all this then, anthropomorphizing or not, and not just the sex bits, but from all the ways that we're similar to other animals?
Yeah, I think that what I learned most about writing the book is that, you know, there are these inconsistencies, these examples all over the place where animals are, you know, if you look closely at their behaviors, and of course, most of us don't just because we aren't in that situation professionally where we're able to examine these kinds of behaviors day to day. But there are so many similarities, and we really are part of the animal kingdom. We tend to mask our behaviors, our natural behaviors, with a lot of ritualistic silliness, I guess you could say, that makes us forget that we are, above everything else, we are a primate, just like all the others, and that we are a part of the animal kingdom, just like all the other animals are. But basically, there are some pretty complex behaviors happening at all levels. And it's really quite humbling to read about how sometimes we get it right, and sometimes it's easy to be human, and sometimes we just get it vastly wrong, and other animals just kick our butts when it comes to sophistication and behaviors. And so, yeah, we're a part of the grand plan, and I like that.
So do I, and we are out of time.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much for being here, Karen.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's always just fun to talk about these great biology stories.
You can find Karen's work at karenbondar.com or at the link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. And we're going to end the show today with one more song by rap science educator Baba Brinkman. One of the things we talked about during our last interview with Baba was the way that writing and performing his rhymes undergoes an evolutionary process of its own. He writes a lyric, tests it out in front of an audience, and then modifies it based on their feedback. It's a process he calls performance feedback revision, and he's followed through by releasing the Rap Guide to Evolution, Revised. You can find links to download the album and the Rap Guide to Human Nature at bababrinkman.com or on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, why not click the links to Twitter, to Facebook, and to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes, subscribe to the show, or leave a review. Thanks for listening, and now enjoy I'm a African, from the Rap Guide to Evolution, Revised. We'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.
Yeah, Africa's my mama. Africa, Africa's my mama. Africa's my mama. So I wasn't born. Yeah, I'm an African, I'm an African. Yeah, and I know what's happening. I'm an African, I'm an African. Archaeologists know what's happening. Are you an African? You an African? Yeah. Do you know what's happening? I'm an African, I'm an African. Geneticists told me what's happening. No, I wasn't born in Ghana, but Africa is my mama. Cause that's where my mama got her mitochondria. You can try to fight if you want it, but it's not gonna change me. Cause it's plain to see, Africans are my people. And if it's not plain to see, then your eyes deceive you. I'm talking primeval. The DNA in my veins tells a story that reasonable people find believable. But it might even blow your transistors. Africa is the home of our most recent common ancestors, which means human beings are all brothers and sisters. So check the massive evidence of Homo erectus and Australopithecus afarensis in the fossil record, and then try to tell me that we're not all connected. The fossil record has gaps, but no contradictions, and it complements the evidence in your chromosomes. So I came to let you know about your ancestral home. I'm an African, I'm an African. Yeah, and I know what's happening. I'm an African, I'm an African. Archaeologists know what's happening. Are you an African? Are you an African? Yeah. Do you know what's happening? I'm an African, I'm an African. Geneticists told me what's happening. Yeah, it's plain to see, you can't change me, cause I'ma be a Homo sapien for life. Yeah, it's plain to see, you can't change me, cause I'ma be a Homo sapien for life.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. You call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell, gonna raise a little hell, break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking, online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon-bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim-flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan, who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus-pocus, out-of-focus locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor, leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.
Skeptically Speaking is produced with the support of CJSR 88.5 FM in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Our studio assistants are Brent Kelly and Rochelle Saunders.
Ryan Bromsgrove is our studio technician and research assistant. The show is produced and edited by K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by A.O.K. And I'm your host, Desiree Schell.